and something for the music.
Thank you very much. So the kind of questions I want to talk about are, what are the values of zeta of s, or ls chi, the chi ranges over, say, Dirichlet characters, or ls chi d, if we range over quadratic characters, or ls f, and we range over some modular forms, let's say just of weight k, and k is large. Now, I've just written zeta of s here, so we could either be talking about something on the critical line or not. Now, I think it's fair to say that the only thing that we really understand about these functions is what happens when we are to the right of 1, where it's absolutely convergent and we can understand exactly how large it gets and how small it gets.
Yeah, not true when you've done error manager.
Okay. For these four cases, as I've written them down, it's true. Okay. Now, so the simplest thing that we can start out with, which we don't understand, is what happens at the edge of the critical strip. So, just to fix one case, let's just look at L1 chi d, which is perhaps the most interesting thing which happens at 1, because this is connected by the class number formula to something arithmetic. And the question is, how large does this get? Can we model it in some probabilistic way? And so on. If we just ask for the extreme values of this, then it's fair to say that we don't understand this at all. And this is, in fact, also a very important question. So in terms of lower bounds, for example, there's a beautiful result of Ziegel, which is ineffective, and it says that this is at least as large as d to the minus epsilon, which is hopelessly bad. We expect that, in fact, it should be as large as something like 1 over log d, or 1 over log log d even, on the Riemann hypothesis. So we don't understand this at all. However, if we ask for the distribution of this as d ranges over fundamental discriminants up to x, say, then we can do considerably better. So we can prove that this does have a distribution function that was proved by probably Bateman and, or Chawla and Erdős, I guess, and Elliot and Montgomery and Vaughan have recently contributed to this as well. Elliot, not so recent, I guess. Now, Andrew Granville and I have been studying this question with reference to the uniformity of the distribution function that we can get. So let me say a little bit about what happens to this. The obvious model we can think about it is as follows. We have L1 chi d. So already this is at the edge of the critical of the critical strip, so what I write down is already not quite true, but we can think about it as being given by the Euler product. And we can think that these values chi d of p take values plus minus 1 equally often. Well, it's a small problem that they can also be 0 when p divides d. So the model which is reasonable to think is that this is the same as the product of 1 minus a random variable xp over p, where xp takes a value, well, it's essentially plus 1 and minus 1 with equal probability. So this with probability p over 2 times p plus 1, and this with 1 over p plus 1, and 0 with, and minus 1 with p over 2 times p plus 1. This turns out to be the right model to look at. And then you can ask, is this really true? And there are various ways in which we can check it. We could take the kth moment of L1 chi d as we range over all the discriminants up to x, and we can ask whether that's the same as the expectation of the kth moment of the random Euler product. The random Euler product converges almost always. And we can verify that for a wide range of values of k, so which gives some confidence that this is actually true. Now, the results have the following shape. If you ask for the probability, so the number of d up to x, for which L1 chi d is greater than e to the gamma times some number tau, say, the e to the gamma is for natural normalization, then this probability turns out to be something like, well, this frequency is something like x times a rather strange distribution function, it's certainly not something like Gaussian. It's something which increases doubly exponentially. Now, of course, this can't be true for all values of tau. There'll be some value of tau for which this is smaller than 1 over x. And at that stage, certainly we can't hope for this to be true, because this is an integer, and this would be something smaller than 1. Now, the place where it happens to be smaller than 1 is something like tau is...
What's gamma?
Gamma is Euler's constant. So the place where this is of size 1 over x is roughly log x plus log x plus some constant. Now, certainly we can't hope to get the distribution function anywhere beyond this, but we can do quite a bit. We can actually get the distribution function. So this probability holds for tau less than log x plus a bit more. So a bit more here is something like log x is what we actually proved. But the reason why we did it was that there was a conjecture of Montgomery and Vaughan which said, you know, does this hold up to log x? And we answered that conjecture. And if you assume the Riemann hypothesis, then one can prove this conjecture for log x plus this minus some constant. So we get pretty close to the extreme range in which you can expect something like this to be true. I guess that means that the random model here on the primes is probably correct if you're looking at what happens for the extreme values of L functions at 1. Another way in which we can think about it is we have these numbers xp which take values plus minus 1 with equal probability, and so that means that if I say want all of them to point towards 1, then there's a probability essentially half for making any particular prime point towards 1. So if I want to make the first y primes point towards 1, then that's an event which has a probability of about 1 over 2 to the y. Now, if I have x characters, then I should optimize it so that if 2 to the y is smaller than x, then I am more or less guaranteed that there should be some characters with that probability for which that happens. So another way in which we can think about it is that, well, what does it mean for y to be, 2 to the y to be around x? So y is like log x, and so that's the primes up to log x times log x by the prime number theorem. So one way in which we can think about it is that L1 chi d is approximately the same as the product up to some constant log d times, so let me put a small escape valve there, so log d, of 1 minus chi dt over p inverse. So this is a conjecture. And we are quite far away from this conjecture. So all we know, well, for example, the z equals 0 thing would follow easily from this conjecture. So we are definitely far from it. But even if you assume Riemann hypothesis, we are far from it in the sense that Riemann hypothesis would give you something like log d to the 2 plus epsilon is where you need to take the product up to. So that's a result of Littlewood, which is that GRH implies the product up to p squared dot d squared is okay. Make it log d to the 2 plus epsilon. Okay. Now...
What exactly does approximately equal?
I mean asymptotically. I mean that the ratio of them tends to 1 as d goes to infinity. Now, I believe that the same thing should be true if we go into the critical strip but stay away from the line, from the critical line. So I'll make the conjecture, which is almost a Fokler conjecture, that, for example, if we look at the Riemann zeta function and we fix sigma greater than 1/2, then zeta of f should really look like the product up to p. And here let me hedge a little bit and put a 1 plus epsilon there. And we can certainly prove something like this in a measure theoretic sense, that for almost all values of t, and even in a very strong quantitative form, that these two things look like the same. And now we can ask what happens when we get to the critical line. This just does not seem to be true. And part of the reason for that is that, well, there are, for example, zeros of the Riemann zeta function, and this product can never be zero. It always stays away from zero. So the natural question is, what happens when you get to the critical line? And people have tried to study this recently, and I believe we'll hear more about this later this week. For example, Garnick, Hughes, and Keating have a model which takes the zeros into account. So what I want to talk about first are how large does zeta of half plus IT get? Now, we know how small it gets, so even though I say extreme values, I really want to talk to you about this, or at least an absolute value. And if we still have this framework of thinking only about the small primes, the primes up to some point, we can again think of zeta of half plus IT as being approximated, at least most of the time now, at least say mostly, it's approximated by the product up to log t times log t of 1 minus 1 over p to the half plus i t. And the question is, what can I do with the p to the i t in order to make this product as large as we can? And it's clear that if I make p to the i t point towards 1, then this will look like 1 minus 1 over square root of p inverse, which is large. So in this way, Montgomery proved, or not quite in this way, but correctly, so Montgomery proved that on RH, zeta of half plus IT gets as large as the square root of log t precisely comes from this. If you take the sum of, if you take the logarithm of it, that's the sum of 1 over square root of p going up to this. And by the prime number theorem, that's simply square root of log t over log t. So that's the basic idea. And you can use Dirichlet's theorem on Diophantine approximation to make the p to the it's point towards 1 for such values of t. Now, around the same time that Montgomery did this, Balasubramanian and Ramachandra actually found an unconditional proof of such a result. And they actually proved a very nice result, which does not seem to be widely known. They actually were the first to consider moments of the zeta function on the critical line, and they were able to get lower bounds for this. So they proved the beautiful result that if you look at the integral from t to 2t of mod zeta of half plus i t to the 2k, then this gets as large as, so this constant is absolute. It was made to be 1 by Condrey and Ghosh, and to be 2 by me, I guess. And they proved that this is as large as the kth divisor function dk of n square over n.
What did Titchmarsh do? He had a Smith version.
I don't know if he had, he had lower bounds if you're on the critical line, if you're away from.
He had an omega result with the Laplace transform thing.
Yeah, but
not
lower bound. Oh, you mean he didn't put a constant? Yeah, but he does have that series which gives the log. And that's how he got t log t to the right exponent.
Yeah, but it's not completely clear what he did. Because, for example, Levinson after Titchmarsh also did not get this result. So I'll have to look it up.
I'm just talking about what's in his book.
I seem to remember he couldn't estimate the large terms here very well.
I think he might have taken one particular value of DKM and got, I think that was actually what Levinson did. So I have no idea what Titchmarsh did. Okay. So it's hard in retrospect to figure out why people did not do certain things. Okay. So from this, and by choosing an optimal value of K, so it follows from this that the maximum of zeta of half plus i t is at least as large as the 2kth root of this, so approximately. And in this way, they got that this is at least as large as some constant b times square root of log t over log t. And Balasubramanian later figured out what the maximum value of the 2kth root of this is as you vary over k, and he proved that b equals something like 0.53 is okay.
Yes, the Titchmarsh thing depends, the constants depend on k. Okay, that's what we call
Maybe.
That's
good. Okay, so, but again, if you analyze carefully the proof of this result, then you actually find that what's really contributing to this, to these moments are what happens to the small primes. And in fact, precisely what happens to the primes up to log t times log t. Those are what contribute the bulk of the contribution to this term. So the other feature is you can ask what happens to these results if we ask about Q analogs for these results. So for example, what happens for L half chi if I fix a large prime, if I fix a large prime Q, can this, can we find chi mod Q with this large, with L half chi large? I guess I sort of set up this talk by posing this as a problem in one of the AIM conferences on RH. So I couldn't see, I've thought about this for a while and I couldn't see how to make L half chi large if I just vary over characters. Now if you ask for what happens for quadratic characters, the situation is a little easier because you can now use quadratic reciprocity, so to make the chi d of p point towards 1 for very many primes. So there's a result of Heath-Brown which shows that this can get as large as square root of log d over log d. So sometimes this happens. And this is unpublished work of Heath-Brown, but you can find a version of his argument carried out in the case of quadratic twists of a modular form. So if you take a modular form L half f, and you twist it by quadratic characters, then you can prove a corresponding result that this sometimes gets as large as square root of log d over log d. This is due to Hofstein and Lockhart. And they used it to give an application to the Rankine-Selberg convolution of half integer weight forms. The L function there is not really an L function because it doesn't have an Euler product. And they show that there's a, the phenomenon of a Ziegle zero can occur in that context because these L values can get large. Okay. Now, it's also not very easy to see how to generalize the method of moments and make it work in families. So the usual thing in T aspect is some version of Bessel's inequality, which you don't have in Q analogs. But recently, Seyoub Rudnick and I have been able to do exactly that, so I'll mention that first, although that's not how I was able to get large values of L functions. So if we ask for what happens for moments, and we've heard about this in this workshop already, there are some beautiful conjectures for what the kth moment in various families of L functions should look like. So for example, if you ask for what happens if you average over all chi mod q of L half chi to the 2k, then it's conjectured that this is asymptotic to some constant. We can just call it ck times q log q to the k square. It's an example of a unitary case. And quite nicely, it's nice to get different answers in different cases, I guess. Has some variety. And then if you ask for what happens for fundamental discriminants, then you get some other constant, I don't know, let's say I'm just going to write CK for different constants. X log X to the K times K plus 1 over 2. So it's very easy to get these constants wrong, as I have done. And so I'll just continue to write the same constant for everything. This is in the symplectic case. And in the orthogonal plus case, so for example, if we ask for L half F, F is an eigenform of weight K, so I should choose some other parameter R, say. If I ask for the rth moment there, then that should be some constant CR times K log K to the R times R minus 1 over 2. So of course I should assume that K is 0 mod 4. When K is 2 mod 4, the L values are all 0, and the moments are quite easy to handle. So these are the conjectures which we expect, and what Zhev and I get is that we can actually get a lower bound corresponding to what Balasubramanian and Ramachandra got. So all of these are at least as large as the conjectured orders of magnitude. So I'll explain this a little later. But unfortunately, our constants depend on K, and we actually get some horrible constants. We haven't made any effort to really calculate what they are, but they're certainly worse than the 1 or 2 that you can put here. So this doesn't seem to give the best maximal order, best results on extreme values of L functions.
We should probably emphasize that one application would be that you have a non-zero guy in the family, but that's
not.
You don't get new cases of that.
No. Well, I'll explain how I do the moments a bit. Now, the new method that I found to get extreme values is, in fact, quite simple. It's a variant of a beautiful idea of mollifying and amplifying in families of L functions. So this has been something which is used very much. If you have a family of L functions, whatever this means, it's a very useful thing to consider things like L half F squared times some kind of Dirichlet polynomial. So this is some sort of Dirichlet polynomial. And we'd like to evaluate this for two reasons, and now I'll give you a third reason. The first reason is this would help you to identify, if you can get an asymptotic formula for this, and you can also control the first moment of that, then it would help you to identify lots of values of functions f for which L half f is not zero. That's sort of what Peter mentioned just now. So that goes under the idea of the mollifier method. Another reason for introducing, for which was first used by Selberg and Levinson and so on. And another beautiful way in which you could use this is due to Duke, Friedlander, and Ivanets, that if you can get an upper bound for this, then you can choose your Dirichlet polynomial craftily so that for a particular function f, it gets very large. And then you would get an upper bound for your particular function f, because all the terms in the sum are positive. And that's the amplifier method, where you want to pick out one value of your L functions. But in fact, you could also use this method to pick out extreme values, because all you have to do is you have to evaluate this and compare it with what you get if you just evaluate that. And then it's clear that if you take the ratio of these two quantities, then of course there must be some value of L half F, which is at least as large as the ratio of these things. And then the trick is only to find out what is the best way of choosing your Dirichlet polynomial f. So I'm going to illustrate this in the case of the Riemann zeta function, so where I'll prove that there exist values of t So this is a modest improvement on the result of Balasubramanian, where the constant 1 is replaced by 0.53. Or the other way around. But there are some parts of the proof which I quite like. One of them is that you can actually do this if you, not by playing with the small primes. So if you take the ratio, if you just divide out by the primes of two, even log t square essentially, so in fact that ratio gets large. So that ratio gets as large as, well, some other constant c times log t over log t. So one can get large values of the zeta function on the critical line without invoking what happens on the small primes. And this simply is not true presumably it's not true if you just look on the sigma line for any sigma bigger than 1/2. And then the other advantages of this is that this works, as you can see, for any sort of family of L functions at all. So you could do this over all characters chi mod q or quadratic characters. And in the case of quadratic characters, you can improve this result by putting a square root here. So it actually improves the order of magnitude in that case. Okay. There is another thing which it suggests. If you consider the idea of using the pigeonhole principle or Dirichlet's theorem to point primes in one direction, then what you find is that in Montgomery's method, the measure of values t for which t lies between t and 2t, and say zeta of 1/2 plus i t, is at least as large as x of whatever we have, log t over log t. So he finds that this is something like t to the theta. I think theta is like 1/3 for some theta strictly between 0 and 1. So in other words, it happens on a very small set. There are very few values of t for which this happens. And the same holds if you do the analog of the Balasubramanian Ramachandra method. They're actually able to prove a large value in very short intervals. And if you follow that through, then you get something of this type. But what we can now prove, so in fact, the measure of t so I can't do this for values as large as 1 times square root of log t over log t, so I have something like square root of 2 times that. But this happens on a very big set. It happens on a set of measure at least t to the 1 minus epsilon, essentially. So now, if you're exhibiting values as large as this on a fairly big set, then you might guess that there should be even larger values where the measure should go down a bit. So, but all that this method suggests is that there should be values of zeta of 1/2 plus i t at least as large as e to the root log t. But maybe they do get even larger. How much larger, we don't know. Now, one thing which I don't know how to attack at all is to get any kind of upper bound on the measure of t for which this happens. If you're on the line, if you're on any line except the half line, it's possible to get upper and lower bounds for the frequency of large values. But on the critical line, it seems virtually impossible to get a handle on this measure. So for all we know, this could be happening on a much, much larger set, and we just don't know. Okay, so these are speculative things on how large zeta of 1/2 plus i t can possibly get. So now let me just give you the proof of this theorem. So the idea, as I have said, is just to construct, in this case, some Dirichlet polynomial A of t, which is going to look like where A and are arbitrary complex numbers. And then I want to compare the integral from t to 2t of zeta of 1/2 plus i t times A of t squared with the integral from t to 2t of A of t squared. Now, sometimes evaluating mean values of this type can be hard, but in this case it's very easy because we never go beyond the diagonal. So let me start with the integral from t to 2t of a of t squared. And if I expand out a of t squared, that's just a sum over m and n going up to t, am, an bar. I get an over m to the it and an n to the it, so it's the integral from t to 2t of n over m to the it. Now, this integral, of course, we can evaluate what it is. And, well, it would be t, obviously, if m equals n. And if m is not equal to n, we just integrate it out. And I think you get something like I times log m over n. And then an m over n to the 2it minus m over n to the it. I think I changed m over n to n over n. Okay, whatever it is. Now, the numerator is certainly bounded by 2, and the denominator is going to be, it's just, so this is bounded by 1 over log m over n, which it's easy to see is bounded by the minimum of m and n. Because if m and n are distinct. Because m and n are integers, so if they're different from each other, they must differ at least by 1. So the way we think of this is that, of course, if m and n are both smaller than t, then I want to think of this as just being a delta function. It's picking out t if m equals n and ignoring all the other terms. And you can justify this by just smoothing out the integration a little bit. So we know what this integral is. It's just going to identify the diagonal contributions. It's t times the sum over n up to t mod am squared. Okay. The corresponding thing for the zeta function. It's also easy to handle. So one of the simplest things to write down for the zeta function is this approximation. It's really approximated by just it's Dirichlet series. The error involved is very small. It's smaller than 1, for example. Let me call this R, say. I already have an M and N. And then we do the same thing. So we multiply this by 1 over AM over M to the IT, and then AM bar over N to the minus IT. So if we do the integral from T to 2T of zeta of half plus IT, then again, you can just see, after doing the integral, that we pick up only the diagonal contributions. So the diagonal contributions here would be something like r goes to t, m goes to t, 1 over square root of r, a of m, and then a sum over n goes to t, a of n bar. But the diagonal contribution here means that r times m is the same as n. Or in other words, this is just asymptotic to this quadratic form. The product MR goes up to T, and AMR conjugate, that's AM, over square root of R. So now we just have a calculus problem, which is, given this quadratic form, we want to optimize, we want to make the maximum of that quadratic form. Okay? And the main result is that actually this optimization problem has a fairly nice answer. So the result is the maximum of So naturally, I want to assume that not all of the ans are zero, but the maximum ratio is actually e to the root log t over log log t. Okay. So I'll give you just a few lines on how one proves this. So first, there's a construction, which if you're interested in extreme values is all you care about, because why do you need to know that you can't do any better? Because it's good to know you can't do any better. So the construction is to take AM to be a multiplicative function. So I need to tell you only how to define it on the primes, or prime powers. And I'm just going to take it to be A of p squared, well, A of p to the k is 0 if k is at least 2. So I just define it on the square free numbers. And A of p is this funny thing. It's L over square root of p log p if p is between L squared and e to the log L squared. Well, just think of it as for all primes larger than L squared. And L happens to be square root of log t log log t. Okay. And A of p is 0 otherwise. For all the primes.
You mean 1?
No, 0. Okay. So it's just supported on numbers which have lots of divisors between L squared and, you know, essentially larger than log t. Okay, so what happens if we choose something like this? So these are very special integers on which an is supported, and they're a very sparse sequence. And essentially they exhaust themselves by the time you get to t. So it's relatively easy to see that if you look at the sum of n up to t of a n square, then that's just the same, it's essentially the same as the sum over all n of a n square. Largely because they're supported on numbers which are divisible only by a special set of primes. And you can make this precise by using Rankine's trick, which is that you evaluate the tails by multiplying by an n to the alpha over t to the alpha, which majorizes the tail. So that's, by multiplicativity, it's just the same as 1 plus mod a of b squared. Okay. But on the other hand, if you look at the sum of an, am, amr over square root of r, then this is multiplicative, so it would be something like the sum over r up to t, a r over square root of r, and then all the other m's, m coprime to r mod a of m square. Right? And once again, you do the same trick. The fact is that only the small values of r here are going to contribute, and then the tail you can ignore. So this again looks like the full sum of sum a n square. Okay, so this also approximated by the sum over all m with m comma r equals 1 of mod a n square. And so if you take the ratio, then it's very easy to check that the ratio is really is asymptotic to the product over all prime p of 1 plus a of p over square root of p times 1 plus a of p square. So all I've done is, from these things, for every prime, I would get an a of p over root p, but of course I divide by this quantity here. And that's it. And now you can just check from this definition, what you get when you take the logarithms is l over p log p, and it just works out. Okay, so that's the construction which constructs such large values of zeta. And the optimality is by a trick. So I'll just write down a few words on it. So consider the multiplicative function g defined by g of p to the k to be the minimum of 1 and L over p to the k over 2 log p. And then you use a Peter Paul argument that if you take A of M are conjugate, then that's less than 1 half of A of M R square over G of R plus G of R times. So you don't even need to know what your numbers A of M are. You just play around with this inequality rearrange terms, and you get that this answer which we have is the optimal answer.
That shows that this diagonalizes.
Sort of, yeah.
That's asymptotic.
Right. Okay, so yeah, this function A and G are of course closely related to each other. Okay, so now in about a few minutes, I want to just say how Zev and I prove these lower bounds on moments. Again, it's the sort of problem which I have thought off and on about for a long time and never gotten anywhere, and then it took about, once we saw what to do, it took about 10 minutes to solve it. So it's really just an application of Holder's inequality. So I'm going to talk about just the moments for L half chi square. Chi to the 2k. And the way we're going to do it is to look at the sum over all chi mod q. L half chi square times some Dirichlet polynomial A of chi to the 2k minus 2. Now here, A of chi is some Dirichlet polynomial which looks like the sum n up to x of chi n over root n. Now, the way we think about it is that, well, there are q harmonics which are available to us, and if we think of the approximate functional equation, we need about square root of q harmonics to approximate L half chi. And there are about x to the k harmonics which are coming from here, or x to the k minus 1, if you like, squared. So if x is a very small power of q, say q to the 1 over 100k, then what's coming from here is essentially irrelevant, and we know how to handle asymptotic formulas for things of this type. It's not a very hard thing to evaluate. But we also know by Holder's inequality that this is smaller than L half chi to the 2k to the 1 over k times the sum over chi A of chi to the 2k to the k minus 1 over k. That's just what Holder's inequality gives here. And that's essentially it. It's very easy to evaluate the 2kth moment of A of chi as well. And so if you take the ratio, then you find that L half chi to the 2k is at least as large as what's conjectured. Now, as I said, we haven't worried very much about optimizing constants in these results, but there are two places in which, well, we have or we will work out exactly what the constant is, because I think we'll get the right constant in these cases. So if you look at the moments of L half chi d to the k, d of x, then this is known so far only for k equals 1, 2, and 3. So for 1 and 2, it's due to Utilla. And the case of the fourth moment seems to be almost within reach, but it seems just beyond what we can do. So Heath Brown's large sieve allows us to handle anything which is smaller than x to the 1 minus epsilon, the mean square of that, and then L half chi d square seems to be exactly of size x instead of x to the 1 minus epsilon. However, by a variant of this trick, Zev and I have been able to show that if you take the fourth moment, L half chi d to the 4, then this is exactly as large as c4 times x log x to the, well, k times k plus 1 over 2 would be 10 in this case. Of course, that's the kind of result I wrote down before, but the point here is that this constant C4 is exactly what's predicted by random matrix theory. So I suppose you could say that we've solved half the problem. Now, And we can do the same thing in one other case, which is if you look at L half, let's say an elliptic curve twisted by characters chi d. It's a very nice problem to get asymptotics for this quantity, and we barely failed to do this. But again, we can get an answer which is at least as large as the conjectured bound. Okay. And there's one more example of these moments which maybe has come up in this conference. Namely, if you take a fixed mass form and you twist it by symmetric square L function of other mass forms, then we can get lower bounds for those moments as well. That does not disprove that those functions could still be Gaussian, but it certainly makes it unlikely. I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
In your moments result, is there any advantage of taking, say, zeta to the k instead of zeta when you, multiply it by a squared?
Well, there isn't. So the reason is that it's true that if you work out what the quadratic form is, I still have it here. So you'd get a dkr here, and the answer will be multiplied here by a k. However, you would have produced large values of zeta of half plus i t to the k, so you have to extract the kth root, and everything disappears. So you get the same result.
These lower bounds where you get the exact conjecture, use the same method?
We use the same method. So what we have is we start out with something like L half chi d square times some A of chi d square and use Cauchy's inequality. And then A of chi d essentially goes up to x, but it goes up to x to the 1 minus epsilon. So there's a small room to play around with. And that allows you to evaluate.
You never face off diagonally.
Well, you do in a certain sense.
You face it in these shorter sums. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the right constant. I mean, for the upper bound, really.
Right.
But I guess the result is really that if you have the mean value of any body plus epsilon,
right,
then you get the lower bounds for all moments. That's the real thing, which is quite remarkable. Because, I mean, you can't do it. If you don't have the mean value, so the minute you can prove that there's one non-zero twist or in the family, then you can prove apparently that there are many with the biggest stuff. Not many in the sense of violent proportions. Which is quite remarkable.
And one other feature I should have mentioned is that this is actually true for what it's worth for all rational numbers k.
Yeah, that's okay.